Welcome back to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. It has been a year, maybe a year and a half since you were last on. Mr. Wetmore, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Would you like to introduce yourself again to everyone out there listening?
Sure. My name is Kevin Wetmore. I'm a professor at Loyola Marymount University. I've written or edited over 30 books, most of which are about cinema and media and theater. And then one about corpse-eating monsters. That's my weird one. But otherwise, I also work as an actor, director mostly of stage and stage combat choreographer. I teach actors how to hurt each other safely. And I am a six-time Bram Stoker Award nominee and the co-chair of the HWA chapter here in Los Angeles. HWA is Horror Writers Association. So I spend a good deal of time thinking about film, watching film, teaching about film, especially horror. I want to know what scares us and why.
I just want to say, you mentioned the corpse eating one being a weird one. That's the one I first talked to you about because that's the one that I caught. It is an interesting subject, but I think when we if we analyze horror film, for instance, I mean, how have you seen it evolve over the years? I mean, do you think that it still holds the same gravity or the same care that viewers had back in when it was first, I guess, pushed?
Well, when we're doing a deep dive in the history, horror is now, horror cinema at least is about 130 years old. The first horror film was made in around 1898, Le Monstre du Diable, my French is terrible, The House of the Devil. And it's just this sort of doofy, goofy special effects extravaganza where these two knights walk into a castle and the devil's there and then there are walking skeletons and bats. And it's just sort of the opportunity to show off special effects in the camera. And since then, we know that, for example, Thomas Edison made a version of Frankenstein starring Charles Ogle as the monster. That film is lost. We only have a few images from it. There are sort of four different versions of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from the silent film version alone. So, horror has kind of been a part of cinema since the beginning, but it comes and goes in waves. And we talk about how, horror didn't really find an audience. Most of the haunted house movies of the 1920s, both silent and talkies, were the house really isn't haunted. It's a group of thieves that are pretending the house is haunted so that they can get away with stealing the treasure in the basement. So horror is always horror comedy or horror action. And it turns out the scares aren't real, much more Scooby-Doo. And then you hit Universal and Universal's like, Dracula has been really a success as a stage play in London and on Broadway. And this Hungarian actor, Bela Blasco, he changed his name or something, as the Count is doing really well. But Carl Lamelli Sr., the founder of Universal Studios, was like, oh no, I want Lon Chaney to play Dracula because he's our horror guy. And Chaney had been a kind of one-man horror thing with the Phantom of the Opera, working with different directors. But the first sort of major horror star, Lon Chaney, was an actor who developed makeup and would create these incredible faces using wire and cotton and different, he pioneered the use of special effects makeup. Again, a missing film, London After Midnight. The stills we have from that of him are absolutely terrifying. So Lamberly loved Chaney. His son, Carl Jr., wanted to do Dracula, bought the rights to it, and the father said, we can make it so long as Lon Chaney plays the Count. And poor Bela Lugosi's out in the cold. He had starred in the stage version, got a lot of acclaim from that, and then Chaney died. And Lamberly, at that point, Sr., was like, ah, screw it, fine, how to get that Bela guy to do it. And lo and behold, a legend was born. And that was so successful in 31 that they decided immediately they would get the rights to the stage version of Frankenstein that had also been going at the time. And they offered the role of the monster to Bella, who was like, I'm not doing it all under all that makeup. People like me because I'm a star. And so they got a British actor named William Henry Pratt. And they're like, you can't have a horror star named William Henry Pratt. That sounds like clownish. Can you sound more like Bela Lugosi? So he changed his name to Boris Karloff.
Good God. Where do you think of that one?
Boris, good Eastern European name, and Karloff, cool. It again, sounds kind of Russian, maybe German. Karl, German, Orf, comes from Slavic. So you Boris Karloff. And it gets to the point that by Bride of the Monster, or by Bride of Frankenstein, he doesn't even get a full name credit. They're like, and starring Karloff as the monster. So he's like Madonna. He doesn't even need a second name. Everyone knows who Karloff is. And he becomes really iconic to the point where Bobby Boris Pickett, sings the Monster Mash and has this novelty hit that's still around today on the strength of his Boris Karloff impression. Night of the Living Dead, the opening scene in the cemetery, Johnny does a Boris Karloff impression of Barbara. You know, the famous line, "They're coming to get you, Barbara." He's trying to sound like Boris Karloff. So Karloff, I would argue, even more than Lugosi. Lugosi's face, Karloff's voice, has sort of stamped horror in the 1930s. During the 40s, we got the war. We don't really need horror because we're living it. 50s, burst of sci-fi horror because the bomb. And the effects of the bomb. So let's go to the Southwest, and you have movies like Them, the giant Gila monster, the giant spider invasion, all these movies about big bugs, the beginning of the end, which memory serves is about big grasshoppers. And in the second half of the 50s, you have a whole bunch of teenager movies because after the war, you have this group of people who aren't quite adults, aren't quite children, the teenagers, and they have two things, disposable income and access to a car. So this is where you get teenage culture, you know, that whole 1950s Bobby Soxer. And the rock and roll music that the kids seem to like so much. They're listening to Buddy Holly and the Comets. They're listening to Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper, who all, of course, die in a plane crash. So you've got the invention of rock and roll, the invention of the teenager for all practical purposes. Before that, people fell into two categories, child, adult. You know, and if you, especially on a farm, if you're old enough to do tasks around the farm, congratulations, you're working. And it's in the post-war prosperity period that people are like, ah, she's only 16. She doesn't need to get a job. Just hang out with your friends. Here's a little pocket money. So the kids are hanging out down at the mall shop. They're going to the movie theater. They're drag racing through town like that dangerous James Dean. And you get this anxiety over the teenager. So suddenly we have films like I Was a Teenage Werewolf that show that teenagers are scary. And then you hit the 60s and suddenly horror gets real. We leave behind that sort of post-war gothic and nuke stuff. And you end up with films like Rosemary's Baby, Night of the Living Dead, as the country gets more radical and dark in the late 60s. And you have things happening like the 68 riots and Altamont, and the Summer of Love turns into basically the year of blood and fear in 68. The horror goes that same way. I mean, one of the most disturbing moments for original audiences of Night of the Living Dead is when the little girl kills her mother. But it's this whole idea of the children are coming for us. And you have films like Death Dream by the same guy who made both Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, Black Christmas, and Porky's in a Christmas Story, Bob Clark, Canadian filmmaker who's got this incredible range of film. And he puts out a film called Death Dream that's based on the story The Monkey's Paw, where a Vietnam veteran comes back and begins killing people in his hometown. You know, and Clark is putting this out like 10 years before First Blood, which everyone kind of laughs at Rambo, but we forget that Dave Morrell's novel Rambo, or Dave Morrell's novel First Blood, that introduces the character of John Rambo, and the Stallone film are actually really serious. They're about this drifter Vietnam veteran who goes up against a local sheriff, and the sheriff's like, "We don't like drifters around here," and the PTSD kicks in, and John Rambo goes in the woods and starts acting like he did in the Nam. And this is meant to be this sort of, you know, thing that, hey, nation, we need to think about how we're treating our veterans. The problem is, you know, that film comes out and then it's Reagan, and suddenly Rambo's in Afghanistan with exploding arrows and a headband. And you're like, dude, what are you doing? You took this sort of anti-war story and made it, I'm gonna blow shit up. Okay. In the 80s, you have the advent of the slasher film. And so what you see is sort of horror happening in waves, peaks and crests, troughs and low points, where in the 90s, a lot of people have soft spots for 90s horror, but no one thinks of the 90s as a great decade for horror. It begins with Silence of the Lambs. It ends with the Blair Witch Project and The Sixth Sense. But in between, we have I Know What You Did Last Summer, Urban Legends, you know, this sort of ironic slashers, all of which were advented in 96 with Scream. There are some good films in there, but for the most part, the 90s weren't a great decade for horror. 9/11 comes along, and suddenly horror becomes huge again. And we have everything from Cloverfield. And these sort of post 9/11 horror films, and then these sort of economic horror films, the reboots of Poltergeist. We go through that whole reboot period, not all of which were necessary or mandated, but you know, okay, interesting. And we're kind of living in a new golden age of horror now, with films like Talk to Me. And the funny thing, though, is when you look at, there are a lot of really great horror films internationally, globally, that have come out. Some of my favorite horror films this year have been in Spanish. But alongside that, we get things like Exorcist Believer or Saw 47, where, you know, Hollywood does not trust the audience. Well, not 47. I think we're up to 11 now.
There's a
But the whole
lot. There's a
thing
lot.
is, yeah, this is a thing that's made money. We can make more money from it. And you end up with absolute garbage that has, you know, the studios put out big budget garbage. like Exorcist Believer. And then you have, you know, a pair of filmmakers put out something like Talk to Me, and it's like, holy crap, this is a brilliant film and utterly terrifying on 1/100th of the budget of Exorcist. So, you know, for my money, the independents have always been where horror really lives. And you've got some filmmakers who are working sort of in the corners doing the most interesting stuff. Jim Mickle, the Suska sisters. There are a lot of people out there that I'm watching going, what are you doing next? Because your last one was really good. So I think we're kind of at a high point right now. The problem for me, and forgive me for both getting professorial and going on a rant here, is that now that horror is both super popular and there's a lot of it, we're seeing the film snobs come in and talk about elevated horror. Well, Ari Aster is elevated horror. You know, things like Hereditary and Midsommar are elevated horror. The Witch is elevated horror. I'm like, no, there's no such thing as elevated horror. It's just horror. There's bad horror. But elevated horror is what? Horror for film snobs? Horror that people who really appreciate Mannion of the Spring and, you know, last year at Marienbad can watch and go, oh, yes, Verity, talking about the human condition. I'm sorry, I don't want to hate on anyone who loves film, but no, for my money, there's no such thing as elevated horror. There's just horror. And there's horror that you can watch and go, well, I'm not really watching horror. Because there's this anti-horror prejudice even within the business. When Silence of the Lambs was nominated for, you know, 11 billion Academy Awards back in 91, and Jonathan Demme won, and everyone was like, oh, finally a horror won the Best Picture Oscar. Jonathan Demme was immediately like, no, this isn't a horror film. It's a dark thriller. I'm like, what are you making up blockbuster categories over there? This is a horror movie. You've got a guy who eats people's faces, another serial killer who's skinning humps. It's pure gothic. Have you looked at your sets? Have you looked at your actors? This is a horror movie. And he absolutely said, this is not horror. And when a person who makes arguably one of the best horror films of all times insists that the film he made isn't horror, we have a problem.
Well, what would you define the word horror, though? Because I think that maybe I would be confused, because I've seen dark thriller, that word, be tossed around, and I've seen other kind of similar tones of words be tossed around, which makes it very hard to define. Like, I'm sorry, if there was blood and someone got their face ripped off, I would just assume that would be a horror.
Well, you've brought up one of the key issues in terms of the trouble of defining genre. Because the word horror comes from the Latin word meaning to get goosebumps, that anything that gives you goosebumps. And Silence of the Lambs gave me goosebumps. So I think horror is sort of, part of the problem is that horror has this reputation as being its lowest common denominators. That, speaking as a member of the Horror Writers Association, when I tell people I write horror, they go, oh, I don't like horror. And I'm like, oh, did you see this movie? Yeah. Did you read this book? Yeah. Did you like them? Yeah. Well, then you do like horror. What you don't like are slashers. Because, and I think this is where we can look at the 80s and go, you did that. Horror has become conflated with slasher films. Jason Michael Freddy is horror. And so something like The Lighthouse or The Witch can't be horror because there's nothing overtly supernatural in either of them, even though there is. There's nothing overtly supernatural in Midsommar or Hereditary, even though there is. And even for that matter, Silence of the Lambs does not contain anything supernatural, but it uses all the tropes of a supernatural horror. It was kind of marketed as a supernatural horror. I remember seeing the trailer for the first time in a movie theater back in 1990 and going, what is that? I need to see it. Is it scary? Are there ghosts? And so I think part of the challenge is people don't really understand what horror is. And the great splatterpunk pioneers, John Skip and Craig Spector, put out this great book on horror in which they talked about when you look at some movies, there's a lot more movies that we could call horror. And that year, the film Amadeus had won the Best Picture, and it's sort of a goofy biopic about Mozart. And they said, look at Amadeus. It opens with a man in an insane asylum trying to slit his own throat. And then the whole film is this sort of flashback as he tells the story about how he gaslit Mozart by pretending to be the ghost of his dead father to convince him to write this requiem mass as he lay sick in bed. And I'm like, so the whole thing's this diabolical plot of a man who pretends to be another man's dead father in order to drive him insane and kill him. How is that not horror? And yet it won the Best Picture. So it's one of these things where we think, you're right, there's a lot of blood, so it must be horror. There's goofy special effects. There's a guy in a creature suit, must be horror. But when you look at some of the stuff that's come out right now, Godzilla Minus One is a horror film. Just won the Academy Award for special effects last night. But for my money, you know, Godzilla Minus One was a brilliant, brilliant film. Well acted, well written, and Godzilla is back to being super scary again. It's not this sort of professional wrestling match that you see with you know, the
Oh, American... dude, I love the old suit, man. That's awesome.
Oh, I adore the old suit. Godzilla versus the Smog Monster is one of my favorite films. I
He had to do
adore.
the full body turn to move side to side. You know, like it was rough.
And I show those to my kids and we bond over them and they're wonderful. But if you go back and watch the original 1954 Godzilla, yeah, it's a guy in a rubber suit, but it's not played as sort of campy fun for kids. It is, you know, it's not Godzilla and Jet Jaguar versus Megalon and Gigan, where you have these just sort of giant monster slug fests where it's guys in rubber suits doing this and then scratches on the negative so it looks like he's breathing fire on him. It's, you know, the original Godzilla is dark and terrifying, and you can't watch it and not think of the Second World War and Tokyo being firebombed. You know, it's a film that's a very traumatized people dealing with destruction on a massive scale. And the first Godzilla is Japan trying to process the war experience, just like Cloverfield is America trying to process the 9/11 experience. And so
Wait,
Godzilla Minus One goes back to that.
I want to talk about the Cloverfield stuff, but continue your point.
Well, just my point is that Godzilla Minus One is a brilliant film. It's a well-made film. Like, I was emotional during that film. I was sad. I had all the feels. And it's a horror movie. Make no mistake about it. That's a big monster chasing that boat. That's a big monster. But when you see, you know, part of the fun of the original Godzillas is he's blowing up models, he's knocking down buildings, and we're not really getting any sense of people being hurt. And in this Godzilla, we see people die horribly because of Godzilla. And I think that's sort of the fun of it is part of the problem with slasher sequels. Every single slasher, the first one is usually quite interesting and original because ultimately at heart, it's a mystery. We don't know who's doing the killing and why. Or if we do know who's doing the killing, Nightmare on Elm Street, it's Freddy. We don't know why Freddy's doing the killing. We just know he's a dream demon who kills people. We don't know who's killing in the original Friday the 13th. We know that it's Michael Myers because it's the night he came home, but it's a mystery of where is Michael? What's he going to do? Why is he doing all this? You have Donald Pleasance as the world's worst psychiatrist walking around going, he's evil. And you're like, is that your professional diagnosis? Yes, pure evil. Okay. So with slashers, the first one is a mystery. We're trying to figure it out. But after that, we know what the mystery is. So we're just there to watch people die. By the time you hit Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, 27, the dream supermarket or whatever, we're just there to see how, you know, there's going to be a death every 6.5 to 8 minutes. And we're there to see how Freddy kills people. Oh, he turned her into a cockroach and stepped on her. Oh, he shoved her head in the TV. Oh, he chased them down a sewer and then threw an alligator at them. You're just there to see interesting special effect deaths. And that, for me, that's no longer horror. That's a body count movie, and that doesn't interest me.
We're gonna touch upon that too, but I want to. I forgot what Godzilla was, but it scarred me for life. Whatever movie it was, pretty sure it was Godzilla. But it was I had to be right when it came out. I mean, I had to be super young, probably like 6 or 7. But I watched a giant hail of ice, like a giant chunk of it, hit somebody in the head when he was talking on the phone, and he was in Japan. And I'm pretty sure it was a Godzilla film. But you heard the neck crack sound effect. And I've been scared of not hail. I'm not necessarily scared, but when I see it, I immediately think of that moment when that happened. Now, I don't examine, well, I think a lot of the public did not examine the Godzilla being a, you know, have a deeper message about firebombing certain cities. I don't think a lot of people picked that up, but I learned about that through studying propaganda and film and talking with film historians. And I'm curious if you've come across other films that have had significant messages like this. Like you can look at like, I look at like propaganda, small stuff. I mean, the CIA movie, The Interview with James Franco and Seth Rogen, they flew that on thumb drives over North Korea, and they dropped a bunch of thumb drives, and people put them in their computers, and some people were killed because of that. But that was a propaganda film, also in part with the CIA. Now, it was a comedy, but it was at least Matthew Alford's work, a historian. He did talk about how there is a CIA did fund that script and did fund a lot of movie. And then there's an interview with Seth Rogen where he does say a couple people, you know, unidentified, he believes are CIA agents that did that. Now that can be conspiracy, whatever, but that thumb drive issue was a serious article and it was a serious thing that did happen. So I'm curious if what other propaganda films or just things you've noticed have had a different message that maybe the open viewer doesn't see. It doesn't have to just be propaganda, but can really give you a deeper consideration for the film's production because Godzilla, through that, is obviously more than just a monster knocking down
Sure.
buildings.
Well, okay, there's a lot to unpack there. I think The Interview is very much an outlier in terms of a film that really is promoting a very specific political agenda. And that mostly when you do that, films don't tend to work very well. There's a reason why Atlas Shrugged sort of died at the box office. Because really, do we want, you know, good old-fashioned American wealthy fascism in movie form? And the answer that audiences gave was no, we don't. I think every film is a product of its time, and therefore, at the moment of its release, everyone who saw Godzilla in Japan in 1954 did think of the Second World War, remembered their wartime experiences, remembered the panic, those who were alive at the time. In much the same way that everyone who's sitting in the movie theater watching Cloverfield, there couldn't be a single person in that theater, unless you had serious brain damage, who was not reminded of 9/11. Like, we're watching Cloverfield and it's reliving 9/11 because we had just lived through it a few years before. I think if I were to show, you know, my current students, and this doesn't make help me feel any less old, my current students are like, "We were born after 9/11." You shut the hell up. But when they're like, "We were born after 9/11," okay, so you know, go watch Cloverfield and tell me what you think. And they're like, "Oh yeah, it's an interesting monster movie." I'm like, "Yeah, because you didn't live through 9/11. You don't read Cloverfield as a 9/11 movie. You just read it as like American Godzilla." In much the same way that no one watches Godzilla now and goes, "Wow, the experience of living through World War II in Tokyo must have been horrible." Because, and here's where I'm going to get academic for a second. Every text, and by text I'm including film here, text is anything that can be read, so to speak, has historicity and transhistoricity. What it means at the moment that it's created, it's historicity, and then transhistoricity. When you look at Shakespeare's Hamlet, for example, it was written in 1599. And Queen Elizabeth is dying. She'll die in 1603, but plays about a monarch who has died. Someone else takes over. And there's all this Catholic stuff in the play. And so you're seeing Elizabeth is going to die. And the last time we had a change of monarch, you know, we're Catholic, we're Protestant, we're Catholic, we're Protestant. So in Hamlet, there's a lot of anxiety over royal succession, over religion, Catholic versus Protestant, and that's all in that play. And no one goes to Hamlet and worries about those things these days. No one watches Kenneth Branagh's a film version of Hamlet and goes, "Wow, I'm worried about royal succession now. What's going to happen when Charles goes?" No, because transhistoricity, we watch Hamlet now because it's an existential crisis. It's about a college kid, or actually a grad student, because Hamlet's 30 years old. But you know, this 30-year-old who's going through his existential crisis, his crazy girlfriend is crazy. The only person he can trust is his high school best friend. He can't trust his college friends. His mom has married his uncle, and so his family's all effed up. And you know, we watch Hamlet and we're like, that makes sense. We know that guy. He wears too much black and listens to The Cure. All right.
Giving me the cure, how dare you?
No, I'm a big Cure fan myself, but I'm okay if you prefer My Chemical Romance. Hamlet's listening to a lot of emo music. Hamlet's sitting around thinking no one
That's My
understands.
Chemical Romance, 100%. Gotta have the red little line straight through your hair.
There you go. So, but that's Hamlet. But that's our Hamlet. Shakespeare would not recognize that because he's like, my play is about royal succession and anxiety over religion and, you know, this sort of ontological mysteries of existence. What happens when we die? Because Hamlet says, you know, the reason why we don't kill ourselves is we're afraid of the undiscovered country from whose bourn no traveler returns. We're afraid of what happens when you die, and no one's ever come back from death. And everyone in the audience is like, dude, you literally just talked to a ghost. You talk to someone who has come back from the undiscovered country, but you don't trust him. So that's the problem. And you know, at heart, it's you know, Hamlet's literally talking to a ghost, and he doesn't believe. He doesn't know if whether or not he should believe if this is a ghost, if this is a demon, or if he himself has just gone cray cray. So there's this whole notion within the play of how can you actually believe and have faith in anything, even your own experiences and senses. And that makes sense to us. You know, people talk about Shakespeare's universal. I'm like, when's the last time you saw Timon of Athens, or Troilus and Cressida, or Henry VI, Part Three? Not all of Shakespeare's universal. There are just some plays that Shakespeare got it right and hit on things that we still connect to. 100 years from now, no one might do Hamlet because no longer is there existential fear. We found a device that allows us to talk to the dead, and now Hamlet's gone. You know, so really, the things that continue to talk to us after dozens, hundreds, thousands of years are the texts that speak to us today because of our own concerns, not because they have universal relatability, but because the concerns they address are still relevant to us. And that can always change. So for me, all horror carries messages with it. Even bad horror is the product of its time. And we can look at, you know, a film like Prophecy and go, it's a giant mutated bear. Okay. And it's rather poor special effects. Yeah. But you know what? It's rooted in the idea of, you know, the EPA had just been created because the recognition that toxic dumping and chemical dumping in the United States is really destroying the environment, and we don't even know what kind of effect that can have. The word monster actually comes from the Latin word meaning warning. A monster is a warning that something is wrong, that something is off in the world. And so when a monster has been created, it's because there's an imbalance out there. Something has gone horribly wrong and we need to fix it. So we are warned by horror. Horror always has a message. And the message, for example, with slashers is really conservative. Don't go out in the woods and drink and do drugs and have sex. Listen to your parents and follow directions. And if you pay attention, then you don't get murdered. You get to be Jamie Lee Curtis. You know, you
I
get to
don't know if I
survive
want to
those
be
people.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Oh, I do. She's awesome. But long story short, the whole idea here is there, you know, there's a very conservative message within the film. And even as conservatives at the time, we were worried about all, you know, you can see breasts and blood, which, you know, teenagers are like, yes, that's why we go. But behind the breasts and blood is the message, hey, if you go out and party and don't pay attention and have premarital sex and do the drinking and drugs, you're going to die and you deserve it. That's a very conservative message.
Don't you think on most studios, though, maybe not so much nowadays, but back at least around the 90s and so, were largely conservative films, at least with the undertones?
Well, the new Hollywood starting in the 1970s, you have these maverick guys who are coming in, you know, within genre Spielberg, Hooper, but also when you look at all those films that come out in the early 70s, anything starring Jack Nicholson, Five Easy Pieces, you've got Midnight Cowboy. You've got these guys who are working both in and out of the studio system who are just, oh no, we're going to give you like ugly, nasty films that just show take drug use seriously, have full frontal nudity. You know, there's the MPAA is sort of created by Hollywood to replace the Hays Code, and both of which were created Hollywood policing itself so that the government wouldn't. We saw this happen with movies. We saw this happen with comic books. I mean, the FCC steps in and tells television, here's what you can and cannot do. And the movies are like, we don't want that. So we'll police ourselves and we'll create a rating system to keep kids away from sex and violence, but mostly from sex. Because, you know, cartoons are incredibly violent. And we're okay, as Americans, we're okay with violence, but we don't like sex that much.
Why can we see a guy's nipples but not a girl's? That's what it's always questioned me throughout my life.
Well, there you go. And why, you know, when you look at sexual exploitation in cinema, it's always full frontal female nudity, not full frontal male.
And you got back in the day, they used to be like you have to have a foot on the floor if there are two people laying beside each other, and then they would just cut away to a window with rain on it, or they would show a train going through a tunnel, and you're like, you just get the
1960 Psycho is the first time you see a toilet on a TV screen. Like the film, you know, films wanted to pretend we don't even go to the bathroom. And again, that's, I get it. It's puritanical America. We're uncomfortable with bodies. We're uncomfortable with nudity and sexuality. We say we want to protect the kids from violence, but you know, that's overt, grotesque, gorish violence. We're okay with war movies where guys get shot, grimace, and you know, then have a nice dying speech. You know, talking about their girl back home or their kid brother or how much they love the other soldiers. So what I think what you see happening is these guys in the 70s sort of pushing the envelope, doing the things that they hadn't done before. And the Hollywood is paradoxical in that the filmmakers themselves tend to be much more progressive and much more wanting to push the envelope. And the studios themselves are more conservative for one reason and one reason only. Filmmaking is a business, and we want to make as much money as possible. And so you're seeing films be changed all the time. You brought up The Interview earlier. I'll bring up Red Dawn. When they remade Red Dawn in the early 2000s with Hemsworth and a few other stars at the time, it was originally the Chinese invading America. And they made this entire film, and the Chinese market said, we will never show this movie. And the Chinese market is so important for American studio films. That's where they make their money back. Even if a film bombs in America, they'll usually quietly make most of their money back in the foreign markets, especially Asia. And China's like, we will not distribute any film in which we're the bad guys.
We
So
noticed
America
that
went
with
back.
Fast and Furious when John Cena apologized for recognizing. He said Taiwan will be the first country to see the new Fast and Furious movie, and he got a lot of crap from China. And yet he spoke perfect Mandarin, surprisingly. I guess during his wrestling career, it was Vince McMahon told him that he should learn another language, and he picked up Mandarin. And he apologized for recognizing Taiwan, which a lot of people woke up like, wait, what's going on?
Because most people don't understand the foundational political economic situation when it comes to film production and distribution. That the more money you spend on the movie, the more money it has to make back. Otherwise, you lose your job, the studio could fold. And those rely primarily on foreign markets as much as they do American. So with Red Dawn, China's like, we're not showing this movie. And they went back and digitally turned all of the Chinese soldiers into North Korean soldiers. And they reshot some stuff. And suddenly, the implausible scenario of North Korea invading the Pacific Northwest becomes the film. And China's like, okay, we'll show that. because in order to make, you know, they're like, we're willing to spend several million dollars more to digitally fix this film so it can show in China than not fix it and not make our money back. So a lot of films, you know, either there are edits, we're going to cut out this scene so we can show it in China, or, you know, the whole Meg series, if you read the original Steve Alton's novel, The Meg, about a megalodon, it's set at the Tanaka Institute, you know, in the Bay Area, run by a Japanese-American family. But the family is Chinese in the movie. Why? Because China put money into the film, and China's like, we don't want this guy to be Chinese, or we don't want this guy to be Japanese. We want him to be Chinese. So a Chinese co-production, the ability to film in China using Chinese stuff, Japanese becomes Chinese, and most Americans don't know the difference. So.
What had the biggest impact, I mean, in Hollywood history? I mean, if we talk about like the Blacklist era, we talk about the whole McCarthy Red Scare.
Sure. Well, that's kind of hard to gauge in as much as there are different kinds of impact. So certainly the Blacklist and the Red Scare have a profound impact on certain filmmakers. The people who get blacklisted can't work, at least under their own name. So you have a huge number of screenwriters who are writing films and then giving them to friends, and that friend puts it out under their name and gives them the money. So screenwriters sort of find a way around the blacklist. Actors and directors are basically screwed, because what you do, you have to be there. It has to be you. So there are a number of actors who don't name names and, you know, who get in a lot of trouble. And there are other actors. The funny thing is, then there's the backlash to the backlash. You have people like Elia Kazan who named names and so can continue to have a career. But then later on in the 60s, when people like that was wrong, McCarthy was wrong, the people who named names, folks were like, you are not a good person. You know, you gave up your friends to save your career. And so when Elia Kazan was getting a Lifetime Achievement Oscar, there was a lot of pushback from a lot of people saying he doesn't deserve it. So you have situations like that. And in that sense, the Blacklist continued to have an impact for decades afterwards, as friendships were broken, lives were ended, you know, people could not work anymore, people had to leave the system. And again, people were much more wary of what they were putting out there. But in the wake of it, we also get films like The Manchurian Candidate. So, you know, there's that kind of impact. I think 9/11 certainly had an impact on cinema, what we could and could not do. Usually, when something happens in America, within a few years, we make a whole bunch of films about it. There have only been two films about the actual direct experience of 9/11, World Trade Center and United 93, both of which critics were like, oh, these are good films. And audiences stayed away in droves. And no, you know, good luck finding them today. I'm sure they're streaming somewhere, but no one says, you know what my favorite film is? World Trade Center. No one says the best Oscar Stone film is World Trade Center. Paul Greengrass is a brilliant filmmaker, but United 93 is a very hard watch. And so people just stayed away. Instead, for 9/11, we ended up watching films like Cloverfield, War of the Worlds, Knowing, films that have plane crashes and cities ending, Vanishing on 7th Street, because that helped us sort of deal with 9/11. Just like Godzilla is about the Second World War, Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds is about 9/11. You know, the aliens' first attack in New Jersey, right across the river from downtown Manhattan, where the Twin Trade where the Trade Towers were. So it's hard to watch. You know, War of the Worlds came out in 2005, and it's literally a reflection of the experience of 4 years earlier, technically
When
three and a half, as it came out in early 2005.
did that change from having like horror films or really psychologically twisting movies where it was mass affected populations? And now it seems like we're back to the point, which, to be honest, we mentioned the kind of like golden era of horror films being like, there are some good ones out there. I did watch Night Swim, and look, I don't know what I was expecting because it was about a pool that was kind of possessed or something like that.
Cool.
But there were some moments like where the kid gets near the pool filter and you hear the voice calling out from the pool filter. I knew something like that was going to be coming. And the person I was with, she's all like cuddled up like that. And I'm just like, I know there's going to be a jump. My mom told me never to stick my hand in the pool filter. But it was those things that still had a bit to it where I was like, I'm not upset with this. Thanksgiving was a good one. I wouldn't recommend taking someone on a date to that because The newest one was not date friendly. But there was the newer age stuff really had more of a focus back on. So this one I would say families, but this was more smaller populations. And then it's also the individual that experiences the trauma throughout movies. Horror films, everyone picks a character that they want or they find they relate the most to. And then they get upset when their character dies or if their character makes it to the end. But we've like the 9/11 stuff you were mentioning, we've never, now that I look at it, we did have films that were mass populations being affected, but I never examined it as a 9/11 thing. I examined it more as like a we, I don't know, society was different. We cared a little bit more, which could be an effect of 9/11 because a lot of people did after that happened.
Well, I say Cloverfield and War of the Worlds, for example, are post 9/11 films because they echo the experience of watching 9/11. They're mediated experiences. We're aware of the camera. And as someone who was alive on 9/11 and glued to the TV that day and living in the Northeast, we experienced it through the camera. Unless you were in New York or Washington or on one of the planes, America experienced 9/11 on their TVs. And so you get a found footage film like Cloverfield, which is someone filming stuff and then running away. And there are clouds of smoke and crowds running and walls of the missing and people falling. There are all these images that we saw on 9/11 that now get shoved into horror films. And those images repeat over and over and over again. New York has a locus of horror. There are all these films that replicate the 9/11 experience as horror. In terms of mass horror, I'd take us all the way back to 1933 in a film called King Kong that most horror before then is what we would call gothic. That it's set if mostly in Europe, sometimes in America, Dracula, Frankenstein, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, The Phantom of the Opera, these are all set in Europe and they're all personal stories. If you're not in the village where the Frankenstein's monster is marauding, if you're not in London when Dracula's there, you don't have to worry about it. And King Kong then comes along in 33 and it starts off as a sort of private gothic horror. You have this small party of people who go to Skull Island. They go through the wall because the natives have offered Anne Darrow up to Kong, this giant gorilla, and wonderful stop motion action from Willis O'Brien. And they capture Kong and bring him back to New York, and Kong escapes. And what does Kong do? He goes through New York, wrecking things, and then climbs to the top of the Empire State Building, where he's finally shot down by biplanes, and his body crashes into the street below. And that's, for my money, I think that's the first time we see crowds running. We see large groups of people in danger. We see trains being derailed. Kong sort of affecting the city. And it's again, monster is warning. This film is being written, right after the crash. The Great Depression is, and we're in the throes of the Great Depression, and there's something out there that can destroy your livelihood instantly. And we hear stories from New York about people losing their money or losing their job, not being able to pay the rent. And literally, they're on the sidewalk with all their furniture, all their clothes, just sitting there, not knowing what to do. And that happening to whole families. And so there's this notion of, at any moment, death could come for you, or you could find yourself homeless, or the building you're in gone. And that's what King Kong does. And there are a few other films that are set in cities, but mostly the horror remains small, remains one-on-one, remains human-sized horror. And then in the 1950s, we're back to how it affects the whole nation in terms of films like Them, The Day the World Ended, The Giant Praying Mantis, because now suddenly we've got giant monsters that aren't chasing you through the city streets. Instead, they're just moving through the city streets, causing destruction as they go. So it's really, I think, Kong is the first, but in the 50s is where it becomes common. And we keep coming back to that. Night of the Living Dead is about the entire Eastern Seaboard. And then we hit Dawn of the Dead, and that's the entire United States. Day of the Dead, the whole world has been zombified. And so the horror is not just bad things happen to me, it's the world it no longer exists because this happened. And that continues all the way through films 2010 Stakeland, any zombie film, Zombieland, World War Z. Is all about the end of the world as we know it. And certainly we have a whole bunch of apocalyptic films that start because of the nuclear arms race, that post-apocalyptic horror, Mad Max, those sorts of things. What happens when the world ends? Well, the world never truly ends. It just becomes a shabbier and more goth metal version of itself. Suddenly we all put on football pads, get mohawks, and fight in the desert for the gas, which I don't know how plausible that is, but it's highly entertaining.
Man, how are you going to be able to YouTube any of your engine working skills? That's the real thing.
Yeah, I think an entire generation of podcasters and YouTubers will die off unfulfilled.
We're trying our best, man. We're trying our best.
I
Now,
know, nothing but support, brother, but when the grid goes down.
yeah, I know. Imagine that. Just a snap of the fingers, it's all gone. And all our work in AI would be gone. That's crazy.
That's the horror, that everything you've done, everything you've lived for, the whole way that you define yourself is now unavailable, is gone.
I mean, if you got my phone number, you could probably still get me.
That's assuming that the phones still work.
That's true.
Since the cell,
I'll have to write you a letter.
if the cell system goes down, that's just it, is there won't be a postal system. You're on the East Coast, I'm on the West. We're doomed. We will
I'll
never talk
find you,
again to the
man.
grid
I will
pulls. Hey,
find
I
you.
appreciate that, sir. I appreciate that. But that's the whole point of David Brin's The Postman, and to a lesser extent, Kevin Costner's, sort of less successful film, is, after some sort of Armageddon in which we are no longer a single nation, we're just these little enclaves and communities, the thing that unites us is actually communication. The ability to send a letter from community to community safely is what makes the world smaller and what strengthens us. And what's able to stop the roving gangs of post-apocalyptic beast men is a postal system. The fact that we can send letters and connect all these communities together allows us to stop the bad guys. And so there's a bizarre, hopeful message there that, yeah, the cell system goes down, there's no more electricity. Mayor Tom Petty doesn't know what to do. But a guy on a pony who says, "I'm here to take your letter, that'll be 10 cents or one ear of corn," if we're using food as a barter system, we can create a postal system that will unite and link the communities and communicate with each other. When you think about technological advances, one of the things that blows my mind is it wasn't until the 19th century we had a unified sense of time in this country, that if you could be in one town and they'd be like, "Well, right now it's 8:50 right now," and the person in the next town over would be like, "No, it's 9:10," and what unified us is the railway system. Because the trains run on time, we need to agree on what the time is. And so you had to have everyone on the rail line saying, "It is 8:50 right now," because that is the 8:50 from Topeka. It arrives in town at 8:50. It might be early, it might be late, but it's trying to get here at 8:50. And we know that at the next town, it's going to stop in, it's going to be 9:10. So if it's 9:10 at the time that it's 8:50 here, by the time it gets there, it's going to be 9:30. That doesn't work. So it was actually the sort of transportation that required us to share time as a nation and have the exact time everywhere.
And we
And then, of course,
lost it. We lost it.
with daylight savings, yes, but we still have unified time in that if I don't know about you, but this is my clock right now. I don't wear a watch anymore. I have this, and it is 8:51, as it just said.
I like to check the shadows on the sun.
Yeah, I count the hands on the horizon. Oh, it's four hands in.
I can't believe they told time like that. Is the sun out? Yeah, that's all we need to know.
Each finger is 15 minutes. There you go. Yeah, there is that. But the whole idea is as we grow more interlinked, we need a more unified system of telling time, of communication. And our biggest horrors come from the idea of that system breaking down. That what took us 100, 150 years to create electronically and digitally and with computers and science can all go away in a heartbeat. One good EMP and most of our lives are gone.
It's what I love about your perspective is I think you're a really good educator, and I think you're very knowledgeable in a lot of things that you have. But I have to ask you this kind of important question. It's also a personal question for my own interest, which is, do you think there's ever been specific people in your mind that billionaires, film producers, anything that have left a giant impact besides Romero? I know everyone mentions him all the time. You can if you want, but for me, like, I have a large interest in Howard Hughes. Despite his crazy eccentricness, his films weren't really bad. I mean, The Conqueror is a historical film, whether you consider it good or not. I mean, Genghis Khan being played by John Wayne is not, a good pick, and it failed in the box office, and 98 of the 240 something cast members got cancer because they were filming on a nuclear weapons site. But you really look at that film and base it, and like, this was a monolithic thing. It's mentioned as one of the worst films in history, but it has a history to it, and it's recognized as such. Plus, Howard made some really good aerodynamic films with Hell's Angels, where I was like, to me, he represents a good point in history when we talk about film. But I'm curious what your perspective would be on certain individuals.
I mean, with Hughes, it's a combination of money and sheer force of will. If you have enough cash and the desire, you can do anything you want. And that's sort of one of the gags in Hollywood is a little 80s or sorry, 90s comedy called The Big Hit, which I actually adore, Mark Wahlberg film. in which that features a billionaire who decides to write, direct, and star and invest his entire fortune in write, directing, and starring in his own film called Taste the Golden Spray, which becomes the worst film of all time within the world of the film. And he's thinking about killing himself when his daughter gets kidnapped. And sort of the whole joke of that is having the money to make films does not necessarily make you a good filmmaker. It just means you have a lot of money and you can do whatever you want, and filmmaking is what you've chosen to do. I find in the arts, there are some people that will make films no matter what. That's what they want to do. That's what they were born to do. They're storytellers, and they're going to tell their story whether they have the resources or not. And here's where then two other factors come into play. Talent. Are you actually a halfway decent storyteller? I mean, part of the joke of Ed Wood is that man made movies and everyone knows his name, but his movies are god awful. Like, so bad they're good bad, except for the ones that are so bad they're just bad bad. Like Plan 9 from Outer Space, I show that to my students because it's such a glorious mess and they laugh and they have fun with it and it's wonderful. But it's not what he intended. And here's why I think Tommy Wiseau might just be a genius. Just not at filmmaking. He's a genius at marketing. Tommy Wiseau made The Room. I remember I was living in Los Angeles when it came out. There were advertisements on TV saying, this guy's the next Tennessee Williams. This is going to be the Academy Award winner for Best Picture. And then you see The Room, and it's a glorious, god-awful mess. And instead, people began to Rocky Horror Picture Show it. They go, and whenever you see the photo of a spoon in the movie, you throw spoons at the screen. They're all, they start doing stuff like yelling at the screen, bringing props. And Wiseau's like, that's what I meant for people to do. And they're like, I thought you said this was going to be a Best Picture winner slash the new Tennessee Williams. He's like, no, I made a good time for people. And they would show it every midnight on Friday and Saturday here in West Hollywood. And Wiseau himself would show up and play football with the crowd and hang out and talk to them. I'm like, this guy's making a living showing his one movie. It was his masterpiece. It was not what he thought it was, but audiences grabbed it. But in fairness, same with Richard O'Brien. They thought the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which was based on the stage play The Rocky Horror Show, was just a goofy camp musical. And audiences are the ones that then made it into the experience that we know Rocky Horror to be today. The difference is Richard O'Brien was like, people came to me and said, do you know what they're doing with your movie? He said, let me get this straight. They're watching the movie, they're creating a live stage show to go along with it, and there's audience participation. What's the bad side here? Like, this is amazing. And he has built an entire career just on the strength of that. He's done other things. He was in Flash Gordon. They did a sequel to Rocky Horror called Shock Treatment, which I think five people have seen because it's not nearly as good as Rocky Horror, but it is a great deal of fun. The Rocky Horror thing is. And so you don't need to keep making films if you make just one really amazing one. And it doesn't necessarily have to be amazing. It just has to catch the audience. So you need talent. And that's the other thing is you need luck. Your film needs to hit at just the right moment. And there are so many things like when John Carpenter's The Thing came out, and that's one of my favorite films of all time, it bombed. I remember seeing it on a military base in Kansas in 1994, 93, in its second release, where people were just, soldiers were going, getting drunk and going to it just because it was something to do on a military base in Kansas. And I remember seeing it and being like, this film is brilliant. And no one else thought so. I thought it was terrifying. And I was like, this is doofy. And now it's considered a masterpiece of horror. So sometimes, they thought Night of the Living Dead was a children's film. It would play matinees in movie theaters in 1968 and 69. And the kids would come out crying. And parents were like, oh, was the film too scary? And someone finally sat down and watched it and said, why are we showing this to children? Because horror movies in 1968 were mostly aimed at kids. Terror from the Year 3000, Roger Corman's The Undead, things that get the MST3K treatment now. Because they're so doofy. They were thought, guy in a rubber suit, it's aimed at kids. And Night of the Living Dead was a serious horror film about serious subjects. So, yes, you're right, Romero. He's unavoidable. You said we could mention him. I mentioned him. I would also, I've already thrown out Carpenter. I'll point to John Carpenter and go, he's changed things. He has utterly changed how we do horror. He's changed things about film. I mean, Carpenter is really untouchable. I think there are a lot of hidden heroes out there, people who have toiled, the makeup artists. The thing is amazing, but the thing is nothing without Rob Bottin. That we can talk about an American Werewolf in London and how it's a brilliant film, but again, without the special effects, that film is not nearly what it is. So, Rick Baker, Rob Bottin, Tom Savini are people who have changed how we view cinema because they make the impossible seem possible on the screen. There are some screenwriters out there who are really brilliant. William Goldman has made films that people call their favorite film. He's really impressive, but I think he's not a household name. If people say I love The Princess Bride, I'm like, oh, so you're a big William Goldman fan? They're like, who? Well, he wrote the novel and the screenplay of The Princess Bride, because no one associates The Princess Bride with him. And if you look at all of his other work, he's got an incredible body of work in Hollywood. And unless you're a film scholar, you probably don't know his name. So we tend to celebrate the big directors. Everyone's like, Greta Gerwig was robbed. I'm like, Greta Gerwig was robbed. And she is a brilliant director and screenwriter. But you know her name on the strength of Barbie. She's been around for decades. So there are a lot of people who just sort of toil out there putting out films consistently. Some people who've just put out one film, but it's a really brilliant film. And it goes around the festival circuit and people sing its praises. But the biggest problem these days, though, I'll tell you the one thing, and I don't know who invented it, so I can't point to the person, but the idea of streaming has really changed movies. Because now a film that you'd show on the festival circuit, hoping and praying you might get home video distribution. Okay, and if you did, people might rent your movie. Maybe not, you know, when Blockbuster and Hollywood Video were sort of controlling most of what people saw in the world. If you got distribution on physical media, on a VHS tape, on a DVD, on a Blu-ray, then maybe your film would get some legs and then maybe you could make another movie. But the whole idea of streaming now is people make a film, Netflix buys it, Hulu buys it, Shudder buys it, and puts it out for people to see, and you get money from it. You know, you get your fees, and they keep their numbers secret. But, you know, here's your $12 for this month because 8 people watched your movie. But as a result of that, you know, now your film has legs and you have distribution. There's so much content on Netflix, including a whole bunch of films from Asia, from Europe, that you would not have been able to see otherwise. So streaming has really made cinema global, and it's really democratized it quite a bit more. Although the power is no longer in the studio's hands, it's now in the streamer's hands. So, you know, Netflix and all of its competitors, when Netflix was the only game in town, they were very powerful. But now, if Netflix doesn't buy your film, maybe Tubi will, maybe Peacock will.
I can allude to the streaming thing because I had Gina Keating on here, who actually did a documentary. And I don't know if you've seen her work before, but she talked a lot about Netflix. Netflix had this weird thing. Blockbuster, the reason why they kind of went out was Blockbuster did not want to evolve. Blockbuster wanted to keep buying, trying to go farther and farther and farther with more stores. But Netflix saw the opportunity market to go through streaming and new devices. Nobody could picture it being out of the VHS or out of the old school DVD, going to a store and grabbing a copy. And Netflix was the only one that really kind of, the owner of that really saw and envisioned this. Now, just she gives it better take than I do. This is about like a year and a half ago, probably around the time you were on. She told me about this, but she said Netflix just started buying a bunch of old movies, but started buying everything. I mean, all these old movies that you could probably never ever think of, whether it was overseas or not. And they flooded their market with so many films. So it wasn't about look at what films we have, look at how many films we have. And then people started buying subscriptions because they could watch various films. Their algorithm is actually something that's pretty surprising. It's not meant to recommend you things that are going to be new for you to watch. It's recommended the things that you already watched so you can watch it again. That's the crazy thing. And like, that's when Blockbuster started to die out, because Blockbuster just, they spent all this time trying to buy up and get these giant businesses, and then they had to start shutting them down, and the owner just never thought about doing streaming. But Netflix was on it from day one.
Well, Blockbuster had the opportunity to buy Netflix and didn't, because they didn't think it would go anywhere. And which is foolish, because when you look at the history, it's technological innovation that continues to make movies, all movies, more accessible. Back in the 30s and 40s, the only way to see a movie is if it was playing at your local movie theater. And some movies would be re-released every few years, the really popular ones, and others would just sort of fade away. We've lost a lot of movies because they went out in their initial run and people saw them and people didn't care for them, so they never went out again, and no one felt the need to preserve them. We don't have to worry about Gone with the Wind, but you know, several of the B movies that were made around the same time as Gone with the Wind are gone. And then along comes television. And one of the first things television does when television starts broadcasting in the home, just broadcast television, KABC here in Los Angeles, is they went to Universal and said, sell us all your movies. And so television began showing movies and chopping them up into, you know, 8 to 12 minute chunks, where here's the first 8 minutes of Frankenstein commercial, next 8 minutes of Frankenstein commercial. And so the only way you could see a movie is if it was going to be broadcast by your local television station or if it's in the movie theater. And along comes the invention of the early competition of the videotape devices, Betamax versus VHS. And VHS obviously wins that battle. But suddenly there's a whole catalog of movies available to be seen at home. And then with the advent of laser discs, which didn't quite take off, I think, the way they had hoped because they were too expensive. But when VHS tapes were like $20 each, you could own all your favorite movies and watch them over and over and over again because you want the pleasure of repeated viewing. And then you get the DVD, and then after that comes Blu-ray. Lord knows what the next television, what the next technological events would be. Well, 4K, I suppose. But again, the idea at this point isn't new technology or new version. It's better quality picture and more extras. That's what this increased technology. There's not a fundamental difference between DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K, other than the quality of the film itself that's now on your screen. It's still the same movie being delivered using a physical device, and that's what streaming did. Streaming comes along and goes, here's a catalog. You don't have to have a wall of 1,000 DVDs, your favorites plus more obscure ones. Here's 10,000 movies available immediately. But out of the, and you get excited by that, but out of those 10,000, you're only going to watch maybe 100, and the same, as you point out, the same five or six over and over again because you're in the mood for comfort food. Netflix's model is that of the drug dealer. Here's a small hit. You like that? I got all this other stuff. You're like, give me my drug of choice just over and over. Keep giving me that hit. Keep giving me that hit. Okay, cool. And that's, you know, but for me, the beauty of Netflix, the beauty of all these streaming services, I love Shudder because they bring back films that I haven't seen since the glorious VHS days of the early 80s, like The Prowler, which I just recently rewatched. And you know, I saw that on VHS in my parents' basement, like back in 84, and I haven't seen it since. So it was nice to watch again and be like, oh God, I was a kid when I saw this. But they also, you know, Shudder also has obscure Indonesian horror films, has movies that I'm like, oh, I've heard of this, but I've never been able to see it. Blue Sunshine, that's crazy. And so you have access to films, especially for film geeks, you have access to films that you've heard of and never been able to see, and they're suddenly out there. And I think most film aficionados have a queue of several hundred films that you cannot possibly hope to finish in your lifetime, because you go half, you spend half your time going through the queue trying to figure out what you're in the mood for, and then you start something and go, I don't feel like this anymore. You watch the first 5 minutes and put something else on, or you sit with your friend and argue about what you're going to watch, and then you compromise. Well, let's just go watch the thing.
Well,
Seen it a few times.
Mr. Wetmore, I appreciate the time. You've given me more than enough. I know our chats usually well, usually around the hour mark typically go on this show, but no, you're a wealth of information, man. Seriously, I really appreciate your perspective. I think you've your students are very lucky. I hope they know it in the moment that they have you on. But I have to have you back sooner than the last time. We're not waiting a year and a half for this one. But where can people find your links?
Where can people find me? You can go to my website, www.somethingwetmorethiswaycomes, all one word, .com. You can look me up on Amazon for my film stuff. You can look me up on IMDb. I am also an actor, so I've done some films on that for a while. Those are really the places to find it. If you Google me, some of my writing will pop up. I review movies for horrorbuzz.com. I write essays for fanbase.com. So I write for various websites out there. If you just Google me, a bunch of my writing will crop up if you just want to see sort of the weird connections being made. When Game of Thrones was on TV, Fanbase had me doing an episode by episode analysis of that and of Westwood. So if you want an in-depth dive of your favorite episode of either, sorry, not Westwood, Westworld. If you want an in-depth analysis of your favorite episodes of those series, you can go there and find those. And like I said, I have a whole bunch of books out there. I have more degrees than a thermometer, none in anything useful. If I weren't writing and teaching and acting, I'd be living in my parents' basement. So my stuff is out there.
Well, Mr. Wilmore, I appreciate the time again. And thanks everybody for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. You can check out all those links in the description below and stay tuned for our next episode.